What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, those of you who are, kind of looking around for an answer to this question or maybe this question over here, and you're looking for a good, reliable source that will tell you what exactly the Catholic Church actually teaches instead of what Uncle Bob, who used to be a Catholic, says the Catholic Church teaches. May not be the same thing. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And those of you watching us today on television, you also can participate. Here's our email address, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. We are ready to take your calls right now. Charles Beery is our producer, Ryan Penny is our phone screener, and Jeff Burson is on social media. He'll be glad to pass on any questions you might want to pose via YouTube or Facebook. We are streaming live there right now. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Couldn't be better. How are you, my friend?
You know, I could probably be better, but I'm okay.
Be an optimist.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. Here's an email, and you're going to have to define a term for me here on this one. This is from Daniel, who says, I'm in a discussion with a double predestinationist and was asked, why would God make someone if he knows they'll choose hell? Wouldn't it be more merciful to not make them in the first place? And again, that's from Daniel. So what are we talking about here?
Sure. Well, double predestination is a position, it's a theological position associated in particular with John Calvin, the Reformed theologian, Presbyterian, Protestant theologian John Calvin, and it's the view that before creation, in eternity past, so to speak, and in his eternity, that God positively decrees the damnation of a portion of humanity. And traditionally, it's understood to be the majority of humanity. God creates for the specific purpose of damning, and then he intends to create a smaller elect remnant for the specific purpose of saving them, and that all of this is supposed to come back somehow and reflect God's glory. That's the position. That's not the way the Catholic Church understands the doctrine of predestination or God's purposes in eternity. The question is actually not about double predestination. The question is, why would God create someone that he knows would choose against him?
All right.
And God creates the human race for the purpose of salvation. He creates the human race so that we can be invited into friendship and fellowship with him. That's the reason that he creates. And that's why the church denies that God positively decrees from eternity past the damnation of a portion of the human race. It's not that people aren't damned, but God didn't create them for that purpose. He created them for salvation. But he also created them with the capacity to choose, to deliberate freely about ends and means, and that capacity for choice is part of the dignity of the human person. And, of course, he could have created the human race just in glory. He could have just created us in glory with the beatific vision, and we would have enjoyed him forever without any possibility of sin. He could have done that. And there is actually a clue in sacred scripture about why God might have done otherwise, why God did do otherwise. Jesus himself says that there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner that repents than over 99 righteous people that don't need to repent. That there's something intrinsically worthwhile in a universe in which the possibility of conversion exists. And, you know, I think in an analogous way, you can see this in any story you've ever read. Would you go buy a novel about a happy family that never had a problem?
Be kind of boring, wouldn't it?
Be kind of boring,
yeah.
Exactly. You know, we ourselves are drawn to those stories of moral transformation and the coming of age story, you know, or
sure.
These sorts of things. I mean, they're archetypal. And there's something sort of written into the fabric of the universe like that, that God himself is glorified in the conversion story, so to speak. And that's not possible in a world in which people don't have that capacity to choose good from a position of evil, having lived in evil, to actually turn around and positively choose God. And there's something intrinsically worthwhile about that that warrants the creation of this moral universe.
Absolutely. Daniel, thank you so much for your call, or for your email, rather. We have one more email, but I do want to tell you the lines are open right now, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Here's an email now from Renee. I've been listening to EWTN for over 2 years now, and I want to enter into the church. Unfortunately, I have no reliable source of transportation to travel over 40 miles to the closest Catholic church that has an English RCIA class. So what would be some suggestions to move forward in my quest to convert?
Yeah, thanks. So I think that you can call the nearest parish to you and discuss the problem with, if you can get the pastor on the phone, talk to the pastor and say, it's my intention to enter the church. I have these logistical challenges. Could we make other arrangements? And you may not get an open door at one parish. You can try another. The priest is not obligated to bring you into the church through the route of RCIA, although that's the normal route.
Uh-huh.
But if it's not available to you, then the church needs to make another way for you. And if one priest can't do it, he may be prevented by his own logistical problems of actually getting out there and instructing you or making arrangements, you keep trying, keep knocking on doors, and you may be able to find a deacon, for example, attached mm-hmm. to a parish who would be willing to make that trip, or maybe who's closer enough to you, y'all could find a way to get together and you could receive instruction privately. I myself am a convert to the church and did not come in through RCIA. Many people don't, and they have situations like yours. So if you're willing to, you know, do a little creative investigation, we'll be able to find a path for you.
Yeah. So, Renee, start with your pastor at your local Catholic church. And if that doesn't work, then, try some of the things David mentioned.
You said that the closest English RCIA class,
uh-huh.
and that suggests to me that maybe there are some closer parishes that maybe have another language, maybe Spanish RCIA, perhaps. If that's the situation, I would even propose, hey, what if I do this for my formation? What mm-hmm. if I read the catechism in English?
Yeah.
Would you be willing to receive me into the church if I do that on my own?
Good
and
idea.
I can testify that I've done that? That might work for you.
Could be. Thanks so much for your email, Renee. In a moment, we've got lots of calls coming up here. Lines are open for you. 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Stay with us. And if you're ready now, let's get to the phones at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We're going to begin this time with Ariel in Kent, Washington, checking us out today on the EWTN app. Hello, Ariel. What's on your mind today?
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, well, thank you, first of all, for answering my question. So I'm looking to become Catholic, looking to take the RCIA classes this September to get baptized in the church by April.
Uh-huh.
And I have a few Protestant friends. One of them is very close to me, kind of like a mentor of mine, and he's more of a Protestant. And so, he invited me to a men's group that, you know, deals with dealing with, struggles and challenges that we have. And I noticed that it's really more Protestant-based. So I'm wondering maybe if Dr. David Anders could help me kind of like figure out what's the better route to take when it comes to going to like a men's group when it comes to, becoming Catholic. And I don't know if you get what I mean.
Yeah, sure. I do. I understand perfectly well. Well, I would clearly prefer, if possible, for you to find a Catholic men's group to affiliate with. And there are many. You might investigate the Men of St. Joseph. If there's an apostolate near you, the Men of St. Joseph might be a good place to begin. And if you don't have that, you can always ask. At your diocese, you can call the diocese or call the parish and ask about Catholic men's ministry in your neighborhood that you might participate. If it's not one at your parish, it might be one at a neighboring parish. And I would encourage you to do that. At your stage of formation in the Catholic faith, you're very young in your Catholic faith. And, I think you would really benefit from rubbing shoulders with Catholic men. And the morality and the spirituality of the Catholic Church is different from what you will get in the Protestant men's group. You're going to have a different conception about how you ought to live your life. There's some pretty basic foundational issues that would, you know, dealing with, for example, the pursuit of purity in mm-hmm. your life. Well, I mean, you know, your Protestant friends might talk very casually about their use of in vitro fertilization or contraception in their marriage and these kinds of issues, as if there's nothing wrong with that at all. Catholic men are going to be more interested in helping you form your conscience and your virtues around, you know, a more robust, vigorous understanding of the life of purity. That's just to take one example among many. Mm-hmm. Reliance upon the sacraments, particularly the sacrament of confession as an ongoing part of your active spirituality. It'd be very helpful to be around guys who have made sacramental confession and partaking of the Eucharist as an active part of their spirituality and their pursuit of the life of holiness. So these kinds of things, I mean, the faith can be learned from a book. It can be. It can certainly be learned from a book. But it can. We really imbibe it and come to live it more generously and vigorously when we share it with other people and can see prudently how it actually plays out in real human lives. Mm-hmm. And so I would encourage you to seek out those lives. Now, does that mean you have to stop being friends with your Protestant buddies? No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. And I would encourage you to maintain those friendships and share the reasons that you're interested in the Catholic Church and invite them to come along to Mass too. But if at all possible, try to make those Catholic male friendships as well.
Some areas have a Curcio, a very active Curcio
group.
Curcio
is another one, sure.
I was involved with one of those for just about 20 years, where we would meet in small groups every Thursday morning. It was a real lifesaver for me. Ariel, thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Let's go now to John in Columbus, Ohio, listening on the blowtorch there, AM 820 St. Gabriel Radio. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello, Dr. Anders. I heard that first answer that he gave to the question about double predestination, and I was somewhat confused afterwards, not only about double predestination itself, but in the answer, he indicated that God could have created us in glory, and that's what I think threw me off, is because I thought we were created in glory, and that it was Adam's sin that caused the fall of man, and therefore we now have the choice to make, either to sin or to not sin, or to go to heaven or to go to hell, I guess I could say, rather than sin or not sin.
Yeah, thanks. So Adam was not created in glory, but he was created in the state of grace. All right, so Adam's condition is not ours. Adam was created with sanctifying grace in his soul, so he had a relationship with God, the kind of relationship with God that we only attain through baptism. He had that from the moment of his creation. But he had some other advantages also. He had the gift of integrity. He had what were called the preternatural gifts. He had the gift of integrity so that his passions really were under the control of his reason. He had immortality. He could have lived eternally. And of course, we don't have either of those things. You know, we have concupiscence. It's hard for us to follow the rule of right reason. We don't have immortality. And so he had some advantages that we don't. But he didn't have glory, right? He didn't have the beatific vision. If Adam had experienced the beatific vision, it would not have been possible for him to sin. When we are in glory, it will not be possible for us to sin because we will experience God immediately and intuitively as the fulfillment of all desire. And so there will literally be nothing that could deflect our will away from its utter, complete fulfillment. I mean, it's a contradiction in terms.
Mm-hmm.
Adam's situation was not unlike that of the angels at their creation. God created the angels in grace, but not in glory. And in the instant of their creation, the majority of them chose God, obeyed God, and they were immediately admitted to the beatific vision, and therefore they can never fall again. A portion chose against God. They never experienced the beatific vision. Satan never had the beatific vision, was not created in that final glory. And will be forever denied that, right, because he chose definitively against God. The conditions of our conception, we are born naturally without grace and without glory, we are powerless to choose God until he gives us the actual graces to turn our will towards him. And when we receive baptism, we receive sanctifying grace, and then we can cooperate with that grace and then love God and love neighbor. And if we persevere to the end and are fully purified from any attachment to sin, then we will attain glory in the beatific vision.
Appreciate your call, John. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here's Larry in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Larry, what's on your mind today?
Well, it's probably a statement as well as a question. When God created mankind, he would have realized that free will would result in this fall and would also result in the need for redemption. So is God's gift of free will does that result in his suffering? In other words, the price paid for our free will is God's suffering.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. No, I don't think so, precisely the way you formulated it, because it would we can have freedom and impeccability at the same time. No, we don't, but it's logically possible for God to give someone complete human freedom and yet not allow them the capacity to sin. All right, so to take an example, the Blessed Virgin Mary absolutely had free will at the moment of her conception, and yet she was impeccable. It's not possible for her to sin. And you say, well, how can that be? How can you have free will and not have the capacity to sin? Well, God has free will. God can't sin. Think about it this way. Free will, the purpose of free will, the reason God gives us freedom, is so we can choose good. So we can choose good. The fulfillment of free will is the choice of good. In fact, every human choice is oriented towards some good. And evil is simply the choosing of a lesser good over a greater good in an immoderate, inordinate way. If I choose, for example, bodily pleasure rather than glory, right, rather than God's glory, then that's an immoderate, inordinate choice. But it's always the choice of some good. Now, we could be impeccable in that we could have the capacity to choose between indifferent goods innocently. Like, give me a blank canvas. Do you want to paint an apple or an elephant? Both of them are fine. There's nothing wrong with apples, nothing wrong with elephants. I can freely choose one or the other. But what I can't choose is something intrinsically evil. That's possible. God could have made the universe that way. He didn't. He made it where it was even possible for us to choose lesser goods over greater ones. Did that necessitate his own suffering? Well, God didn't have to redeem us. Right, so he could have created a universe in which we're just talking about possibilities here.
Right.
He could have created a universe in which there was a possibility of human sin, and no possibility of redemption. Now, an interesting question is: would God have redeemed us? Would Christ have become incarnate, even without human sin?
Mm.
And there are two schools of thought on that in Catholic tradition. The Thomists, following St. Thomas Aquinas, say the only thing Revelation ever tells us is that Christ became incarnate to redeem us from sin. So they say if man hadn't sinned, Christ would not have become incarnate. The Scotists, however, following John Duns Scotus, blessed John Duns Scotus, said no, the incarnation was such a great good in and of itself that we would come to share God's nature in this particular way, the divine and the human joined in one person. That even if man hadn't sinned, God might have become incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ. That's just a speculative opinion.
It's fascinating.
Either one is an allowable opinion in Catholic theology.
Okay. And there you go, Larry. Appreciate your call. This is called a communion here on EWTN. By the way, we are all over social media. Our Twitter handle is @EWTN Radio, @ EWTN Radio if you are interested in Twitter. Also, you can follow EWTN Radio on Instagram, which is something fairly new for us. Glad to be there as well. Mother always said, Mother Angelica always said, got to be where the people are. So if the people are trying out new media of this sort and that sort, let's us be there as well. Call to Communion in progress here on EWTN. Let's go to Claire now in Charleston, South Carolina. And Claire, what's on your mind today?
Hi. My fiancé recently went through RCIA. He's been going to the Catholic Church for 10 years. And when it came to start practicing for Easter, they told him that he could not participate in the final sacraments of communion and confession, communion and confirmation until the annulment went through. And is that a normal practice? Because it really felt wrong.
Okay, thanks. So it really depends on the specific circumstances. So to be civilly divorced, just the fact that someone is civilly divorced, is not necessarily an impediment to being fully received into the church and practicing sacramental life, even in the absence of an annulment. And under what circumstances would that be the case? Let's say you've got somebody who's married. They want to be married, and their spouse leaves them. They're no fault of their own. Mm-hmm. They have done no wrong.
Right.
They're not at fault. And they have not contracted any other marriage. They're just the aggrieved, wounded party in a broken relationship. Well, that's not the person's fault, and it's not an impediment to their living a sacramental life. Now, in that situation, a person cannot go and contract another relationship and try to contract marriage mm-hmm. until they can verify that the first relationship was null and void. Because, you see, you can't be married to two people. Right? That's bigamy and adultery. And if you're validly married to one, you have to wait till one of you dies before you can validly marry somebody else. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to determine whether that first relationship is null and void or a valid marriage before you go off and contract another relationship. So I don't know the specific circumstances, but it sounds like it's not so much the fact of the divorce or waiting on the annulment, as it, since you refer to this person as your fiancé, there's a presumption here that, well, I'm going to get married again. Mm-hmm. Well, we got to hash out who I'm married to, right? Because you're not going to be received into the church if you're living in a way that directly contradicts the church's moral teaching. And, you know, adultery or bigamy would contradict that. So it's not the divorce per se. It might be, and I'd have to, you know, get into the mind of the priest and the canonists involved here, and I can't speak to the specifics, but that could be the concern. So not necessarily, but could be given the circumstances.
Very good. All right, Claire, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate it. Edmund's checking us out on Facebook today. Edmund wants to know, is Jonah and the whale, Noah's Ark, etc., are these allegories, or did these things actually happen?
Well, first of all, that's a false dichotomy.
Oh.
All right. So a thing can be a literal historical event and also be an allegory.
Okay.
Right. An allegory simply means that you have one textual account mm-hmm. that by its narrative structure is intended by God also to point towards a future fulfillment in Jesus. Clearly, Noah's Ark and Jonah and the whale are allegories. Unambiguously, they're absolutely allegories because the New Testament treats them that way mm-hmm. and specifically refers to them as figuring and modeling events that would take place in the life of Jesus. Are they literal historical events? I will let you form your judgment on that based on what you think the textual, archaeological, and geological evidence shows. I personally am not heavily invested in any answer to that question. Nothing in my faith hangs on that question.
All right. Edmund, thanks for checking us out today on Facebook. We hope that's of assistance to you. In a moment, we'll be talking with Rosa in St. Genevieve, Missouri, by the way. And we've got some lines open for you as well, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. If you're watching us today on television, you can also join in by email. ctc@ewtn.com is our address, ctc@ewtn.com. Let's go to St. Genevieve, Missouri now and talk with Rosa, who's listening on Covenant Radio. Hello, Rosa. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Anders. I have a quick question. I'll make it very quick. My brother's wife is pregnant, and they have already two kids, and they cannot afford to raise the baby, and they asked me if I will be able to adopt the baby. But the problem is they turn away from Catholic Church. They convert to Seventh-day Adventist. And I already asked and advised from our parish priest here, and she said that I had to tell them the truth, that I cannot adopt the baby. So I don't know if I have the right decision or not.
Okay, thanks, Rosa. I appreciate the question. So I think the fact that they became Seventh-day Adventists is not the major question here, because if you adopt the child, you're going to raise the child as a Catholic. And if asking you to adopt it means to take over the responsibilities of a parent,
right,
and you are this child's parent, and at that point, they lose the legal and the moral right to tell you how to raise the child. It becomes your child, not their child. And if you determine to raise your child Catholic, that is none of your brother's business. And if he says you shouldn't raise your child Catholic, you can smile and then go raise your child Catholic, right? And that's exactly what you should do. The real question is, do you want to adopt this child? Can you afford to adopt this child? Can you take care of the child? Can you fulfill the duties of a mother to this child and bring this child to maturity in the Catholic faith? If you can and you wish to, then it would be a noble thing to adopt a child. But I think that if you make that decision, and I'm not telling you to make that decision, only you can make that decision, you must insist that your brother understand, if you give me this child to adopt, we're going to do this legally. We're going to go in front of a court. We're going to have the paperwork drawn up. And I become this child's parent. And, you know, you can be an uncle, but you lose the right to tell me how to raise my child.
Exactly. Rosa, we will be praying for you. Thank you so much for checking in with us today here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Last chance for you to get those calls in. And that number, 833-288-3986, 833-288-EWTN. Let's go now to a call that came in overnight on our listener comment line.
Ben from San Angelo, Texas. I'm a Protestant at the moment, and I'm wanting to convert to the Catholic Church through RCIA. And I just want to know, how do you get involved in going into college? How do you get involved in the Newman Center, and how do you really live out your Catholic faith in college?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the question. So I really appreciate the question. Thank you. The first thing is, how do you get involved in the Newman Center? You walk in the door.
Good start.
Right? And if they have a physical location on your campus, you have a campus ministry office, you walk in and you say, I'm here. And you start going to Mass, and you start going to the sacraments, and you look at what programming they have up, and they'll have, you know, they might have weekly Bible studies, they may have this, they may have that. You start going to things, and they'll probably have a pizza night on Sunday nights or something. You go eat pizza. You just go and spend time there and start rubbing shoulders mm-hmm. with Catholics. That's mm-hmm. what you do. There are other Catholic ministries involved on campuses. One, and they may not have one on your campus. They might. I don't know. Focus, which is the Fellowship of Catholic University Students, is very active on many campuses, and I strongly recommend that you look into whether or not there is a Focus chapter on your campus. And then, you know, further down the road, I wouldn't start this as a freshman, the Dominicans of the Eastern Province, Dominican Order, American Dominicans, have a ministry called the Thomistic Institute. And this is some pretty highfalutin philosophy and theology. But they work to form cells on campuses, and if you have a branch of the Thomistic Institute on your campus of student organized, then they will send speakers out to speak at a pretty high level to college students about matters of Catholic faith and practice. And that's something that's worth looking into. So there are a lot of different agencies. Newman Center, a lot of times there'll be a university parish. It may not be a Newman Center per se. It may just be an associated parish near your campus. If you don't see anything listed in the sort of roster of campus ministries that says Catholic on it, just start poking around and find out what parishes are within, you know, a commutable distance and call them up, see if they have college ministries if you can't find anything else that's actually present there on your campus. So a lot of things you can do. Finally, wear a crucifix. And, you know, you don't have to be showy. You don't have to beat people over the head with a catechism. But there are subtle ways that you can make your Catholic identity known. Put a crucifix up in your room, perhaps. And you might be surprised at what that elicits in the way of conversation. And if I might, I'm going to tell a little story from my own university days. I was not a Catholic when I was in university. I was a Protestant and not a very good one at that. And I went to a school that was, a bit bacchanalian in its sense of diversion. And, you know, young people kind of went off the rails in terms of excess of all kind. There was one fellow on my floor who did not tend to go off the rails by way of excess. And he wasn't a prude, and he wasn't judgmental. And he was a nice fellow, but he seemed to keep his head on straight. And I noticed that he always wore a crucifix around his neck. And he seemed like a fine sort of fellow. And I remember one time I felt kind of a moment of spiritual crisis. And I wasn't a Catholic, and I wasn't positively inclined towards Catholics. But the only guy I could see in the entire dorm who had his head above water was this fellow, happened to be from Texas, from Dallas, who wore that crucifix around his neck. His name was Dave. And I said, mentioned him in my book.
Yes, you did.
And I said, Dave, you know, I got this issue going on. Would you pray for me? And Dave and I prayed together. I never will forget that. And he was the first Catholic in my life that made an impression on me, a positive impression that kind of belied the stereotypes I had grown up with. And so put that crucifix on or hang it up on your wall, and you never know what might come of that.
These are great resources, great things to keep in mind, because the college years can be a bit of a minefield, can't they?
They're critical. And statistically speaking, most people sort of get set in their ways in college, and they don't grow much after that.
Yeah.
And so how you form yourself and your peers in that age group is just an unbelievably crucial time of life.
Super advice. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for your call to communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Cecilia's checking us out today on Facebook. Cecilia says, I'm having a conversation with someone who says she prays for Satan's conversion and then his return to God. I need guidance on this. She says that since we all pray for conversion of evil ones, would that not include Satan? So should or should she not do this? And again, that's from Cecilia.
You should definitely not pray for the conversion of the devil, and it is a dogma of the Catholic Church that his fall is irredeemable. And in fact, St. Thomas Aquinas, in his compendium of theology, commenting on the Nicene Creed, comments on the line, for us men and for our salvation, he came down from heaven. And according to Thomas, this is his interpretation, the Council Fathers inserted the phrase for us men, not because they were chauvinists, but to exclude the error of the originists who believed in the redemption of the devil. And the point of the article is that God sent his Son to redeem humanity and not the fallen angels. So every time you go to Mass and you say, for us men and for our salvation, you intend the exclusion of the fallen angels from that article about the redemption. It's actually built into the fabric of our confessional practice on a weekly basis. Don't pray for the conversion of the devil. You might as well pray for square circles.
Yeah.
All right? The nature of his choice was irreformable. It was permanent and definite.
One and done.
One and done, exactly. Plus, you just don't need your moral imagination caught up in the question of the devil and his personality. That does not need to be an active part of your spirituality. And there's you need to have the focus of your spirituality being on Christ and the love of your neighbor. And the devil is your enemy and seeks only your destruction. And he won't appreciate your prayers on his behalf.
Yeah, at all. We do appreciate that, Cecilia. Thanks for checking in with us today on Facebook. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Once again, Dr. David, you're going to have to define a term for us here. This is an email from Craig. Are sedevacantists considered to be heretics? And is their consecration of hosts valid? What are we talking about here?
Okay, thanks. Are they heretics? Well, so sedevacantists are those who believe that there is currently no pope. All right? That's the doctrine.
Empty chair.
It means empty chair. They believe that the See of St. Peter is currently vacant. That's why sede vacant. Yes.
Okay. All right?
The dogma of the infallibility of the church, we can distinguish two types of infallibility. There's the primary objects, the principal objects of infallibility, which are those truths that have been revealed by God in sacred scripture or tradition. And then there are things that are connected to the dogmas of the faith in a way that you can't deny the one without denying the other. And those are called the secondary objects of infallibility.
Okay.
Traditionally, church has understood one of the secondary objects of infallibility is the ability of the church to determine whether there has been a valid papal election. Right? And you can see how you can't deny that dogma without throwing the whole question of the magisterium into question. Because if you couldn't be certain that we had valid popes and valid bishops, then you couldn't be certain of any of the primary doctrine, the primary objects of infallibility. Well, what if none of the bishops present at the Nicene Council were validly ordained and it wasn't a valid council? Well, then the dogma of the Trinity would be thrown into question. You see, so you have to have faith in the primary objects of infallibility, but also those that fall under the church's secondary objects of infallibility, which include the validity of the election of the Bishop of Rome. And so the sedevacantist position is mad. It's crazy. It's a lunatic position. You can stop any, well, maybe not any, but I bet you could stop taxi drivers in Burma and say, who's the Pope? And I bet you they would know who it was. And if they didn't, they at least have some, didn't that guy wearing white over there in Rome? You know, the whole world knows who the Pope is.
Sure.
Right? And so it's a lunatic position. It's a lunatic. Do sedevacantist priests have valid sacraments? Depends on whether or not they were validly ordained.
Wow.
And that's going to vary depending on the little sect. And there are lots of little sedevacantist sects running around, and some of them do not have valid orders, and some of them do. I mean, all you have to do is you could be a validly ordained Catholic priest or bishop and then lose your head and go off the reservation, and you could have valid orders and just be a nut job.
Could be. All right. Oh, well, we do thank you for that question, Craig. You can send us an email if you wish, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Call to Communion here in progress. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. I don't know about where you are, but here in Alabama, the weather is absolutely fantastic. I believe it's in the 80s today. You may want to check out making a spiritual pilgrimage to coming to Alabama. Consider the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament. You can visit the final resting place of our foundress, our dear Mother Angelica. You can also tour the EWTN campus. It's only about an hour away from Hanceville, Alabama, which is where the shrine is. We would love to see you. We do tours just about every day. So start your Catholic pilgrimage today with EWTN. Here's what you do. Call 205-271-2966. That's 205-271-2966. Or you can go to EWTN.com/pilgrimage. EWTN.com/pilgrimage. Why don't we pick up another call that we received overnight from our listener comment line.
How do I explain or share when someone tells me that the Catholic religion has too many rules. I always tell them that we have rules everywhere. We have traffic rules. We have rules at work. We have rules in our home. There's rules everywhere, and without rules, there would be chaos. But unfortunately, without referring to the Bible or giving something a little bit more sound than that, it doesn't, my reasoning doesn't really stick.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, at one level, there are only two rules in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Love God above all things. Love your neighbor as yourself. You do those, you're saved, no matter what. Even if you have no explicit knowledge of any other rule promulgated by any authority on planet Earth. And in fact, if we perfectly lived those commands, we would hardly need any other rules, or at least very few. You know, we might have to say you drive on the right side of the road and I drive on the left. You know, but almost no rules would be necessary if we all lived those perfectly. Those really the only two rules that ultimately matter in the Catholic faith. Love God above all things. Love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, we can formulate those abstractly as rules. But, you know, if you from the inside out, so to speak, you experience that as a single act, right? Love as a habit is just a disposition to always will the good of the other and to desire to be in union with that other. And you don't experience that. You don't experience the love of your wife as a rule. Oh, gosh, I got to get up and love my wife today. You know, you love your wife. You love your children, and it flows from you, from your innermost being, as an act of generosity and as defining your character. That's really, at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters. But that love, we can think about what love entails in concrete circumstances. So, you know, Tom, I love you, and therefore I'm not going to kill you.
Well, I appreciate that.
Right. So I can formulate, what does it entail to love Tom Price? Well, for starters, not killing him, right, is a pretty good beginning, right? I'm not going to steal from you. I'm not going to lie to you, and so on and so forth. And we can begin to spell out those entailments in the form of, you know, moral dicta, moral commands. And then, you know, let's say we decide to take a road trip, Tom and I, which we hadn't done. Maybe we do that one day.
We should do that.
All right. You know, I love Tom, so I'm not going to drive on the left side of the road, because otherwise I'd expose him to danger. Now, how did I come up with that arbitrary rule? Well, it's a convention of my culture that we drive on the right side of the road. And as Christians living together in community as a church, we do similar things, right? We have conventions about how we can live well together. These things, many of them, can be changed. We ought not to change them casually. I mean, culture and convention can have the force of law, habit, and so forth. But they're there for good order and good. So St. Thomas says that a law is nothing other than an ordinance of reason for the common good. And you have to have principles to govern our common life together, and some of them are entailed precisely by the command to love. Now, it may be that your friend's objection to the so-called ruleness of the Catholic faith is prompted by a kind of antinomianism, which is, I don't want anybody to tell me what to do.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's not very loving. That's egotistical. That can be narcissistic. And I can understand why you wouldn't want to have any rules if you want to be able to, you know, write your own story and not listen to anybody else. But then you're not really regarding the good of your neighbor. It also might be maybe an innocent ignorance of what the purpose of some of the, say, the canons of the Catholic faith are. You mentioned evidence for this in sacred scripture. Well, St. Paul even goes so far as to dictate how to dress and how to handle your hairstyle for appropriate decor in Holy Mass. And he references, in essence, what is canon law. And this is first, they didn't call it canon law back then, but in 1 Corinthians 11, he says, if anyone wants to have another practice, or if he wants to be dissenting, he says, no, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. He actually references the consensus of the church about liturgical propriety as a binding norm. And why? That all things be done decently and in order for the sake of the common good, you say. Now, is it also possible that the church might have a rule of some kind that makes no sense and we ought to change? Sure.
Sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, and we're, you know, we're going on multiple iterations of canon law now. You know, I mean, Pope John Paul II overhauled the whole thing in 1983. We had another overhaul in 1917. We might get another one down the road. I mean, yes. I mean, the human aspect of law can be changed according to the circumstances and needs of a generation. But the principle of law is just an ordinance of reason for the common good.
Very good. Call to communion here on EWTN. We have a bit of a blank check email for you, and I know you're going to love this. This is from Rick. He says, what is wrong with being a Protestant? Why should someone convert to Catholicism?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Let me answer this in two ways. Basically, there may be nothing wrong with being a Protestant, except that you just don't have all that you need. I mean, you may have some very good things, mm-hmm. but you don't have everything that you need. And, you know, my granddaddy was a great Baptist. And I like to tell people, man, granddaddy got more grace out of his two sacraments than I get out of seven. You know, he was just a great, fine fellow with a great integrity. I need all seven. You know, I need the full thing because I'm just not as good a guy as he is. And I'm not going to criticize my grandfather. He was a wonderful man. But he was denied some resources through no fault of his own. Some riches, some treasures that he could have laid hold of and made great use of if he had been able. You know, I mentioned the sacraments. Another one would be, you know, my grandfather, wonderful man, probably could not have given a good account of his faith or how it should be applied to the civil order or to his common life with his fellow Baptists in Northport, Alabama in the 1940s. Granddad, it didn't sit well with him, right? The racial regime of the pre-civil rights era South. But he lacked the vocabulary and the philosophical sophistication to explain that or to defend a coherent doctrine of human dignity and the common good. If he'd had access to the Catholic intellectual tradition, he might have had the terms in which to make that case more coherently, mm-hmm. more cogently. And, of course, the Church has been making that case for quite some time. So when you become Catholic, you get more means of grace. You get more light, more truth, and the benefit of more wisdom embedded in tradition that enable you ultimately to live a holy life and be united to God. Now, in my own case, I also found other objective deficits, not just lack, but positive harms that I experienced in my own Protestant walk. Now, I'm not saying you do. I'm saying I did.
Right.
Right. One of them was this conviction that I had been given from childhood that I could be saved by faith alone without regard to my moral life. And that was a tremendous stumbling block to me because I conceived my primary religious duty to be thinking right and making other people think like me. Made me a wonderful dinner guest, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I didn't really conceive of my primary religious duty in terms of the formation of my own virtues. And my tradition didn't form me that way. And though my granddaddy was a virtuous man, he didn't have the vocabulary of virtue to give me, you know, nor did my parents. And so when I arrived at early adulthood, I found that I lacked conceptually and by habit forms of life that I desperately needed to be successful as a young man, as a husband, as a father. And I also experienced the lack of grace in my life to actually live out those arduous demands of family life. And then I discovered the Catholic faith, and the Catholic faith said, well, number one, you're not saved by faith alone. You need transformative grace in your inner life to make you fundamentally a better person, and we can help spell that out, what that looks like. Let's talk about the life of virtue. And let's also, for that matter, talk about the duties of family life and what it means to be a good husband and to live a sacramental marriage and all of these categories that I had been denied. And I experienced those as powerfully liberating, dignifying and elevating, and I went from the good to the much, much better.
Mm. And along the way, there was a little humbling, wasn't there?
I was quite a bit. You want to read about it, read my book, The Catholic Church Saved My Marriage.
Yeah, it is a great book, and I know, you know, from talking with you and your wife said, Maybe this part, David, maybe that's a little too humble, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, I gave her veto power, and she used that veto power two or three times. No, you're not saying that.
That's funny.
No.
Anyway, it really is a great book, The Catholic Church Saved My Marriage. It's available from us, from EWTN Publishing. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
We do the radio show Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. We also have an encore for you the same evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, and we have a best of show on Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, you can check out the podcast any time of the day or night at EWTNradio.net. EWTNradio.net. On behalf of our fabulous team here, Charles Beery, Ryan Penny, and Jeff Burson, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Have yourselves a wonderful day. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.